Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eric LeCompte, Executive Director of the Jubilee USA Network, who explains why his group and others are advocating debt relief for both Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands after the destruction of recent hurricanes. Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program, who explores the potential of post-hurricane shattered Puerto Rico to become a model for conversion to renewable energy. And Frederick Clarkson of Political Research Associates, who assesses the significance of Christian right extremist Roy Moore's Republican Senate primary victory in Alabama. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
More than 90% of Kurds living in northern Iraq voted in favor of establishing an independent Kurdistan in a September 25th non-binding referendum. Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and the United States opposed the move toward creating the first Kurdish state. The current semi-autonomous Kurdish region is rich with oil reserves and is a key ally in the military campaign against the jihadist Islamic State, or ISIS. Days after the plebiscite, Iraq, in a first set of promised economic sanctions, halted international flights to Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish region. Turkey has threatened to shut down the oil pipeline, which pumps over 600,000 gallons of Kurdish oil to Turkey daily. Iraq also pledged to retake oil fields in the city of Kirkuk, which has been under control of the Kurdish army since 2014, when the Iraqi army fled in the face of an ISIS offensive in the region. Today, over 30 million Kurds live across the Middle East, concentrated mostly in Iraq, Turkey, Syria, and Iran. After World War I, the Kurds were ruled by the British and later Iraq. Over the last century, the Kurds have waged a number of rebellions to win their independence. In 1991, they won a semi-autonomous state inside Iraq during the first Persian Gulf War and remain under the protection of Western powers. After a weekend of tweeting insults against African-American pro football players, President Donald Trump came face-to-face with the growing humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico. The Commonwealth of 3.5 million people took a direct hit by Category 4, Hurricane Maria, and after 2 weeks, most of the island is without power, running water, or cell phone service. As a sign of the mounting crisis, hundreds of cargo containers filled with emergency supplies, including food and water, were stranded in a San Juan port. The crisis is provoking a new exodus of Puerto Ricans to leave the island for the U.S. mainland. Meanwhile, President Trump launched a Twitter war against the people of Puerto Rico, who have been critical of the federal government response, including the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz, who had made an emotional televised plea for help for her city. Prior to Hurricanes Maria and Irma, Puerto Rico's infrastructure was the victim of a decade-long debt crisis and deep recession. The island's government is now seeking to restructure over $120 billion in debt in U.S. courts. While electric power was restored after Hurricane Irma, Maria left the electric grid effectively destroyed with little prospect for power or cell service to return anytime soon. American energy experts, now in Puerto Rico, say restoring the island's power will involve much more than replacing downed poles and cables. The entire system of generation, transmission, and distribution must be rebuilt, including replacement of high-voltage transmission lines. The election of Donald Trump and his appointed right-wing Justice Department, led by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has pushed the Black Lives Matter movement to rethink its political strategy. The movement first emerged after the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the murder of Florida teenager Trayvon Martin. Black Lives Matter has largely been defined by its protests and the aftermath of police shootings of young black men and demands to reform the criminal justice system. But now, Sessions and Trump are moving to remilitarize local police departments. With their eyes on midterm elections in 2018, Black Lives Matter organizers are focusing on mobilizing the black vote and challenging voter repression laws. The Lansing, Michigan chapter of Black Lives Matter is promoting a statewide Get Out the Vote campaign called Election 20XX. As the midterm elections draw near, organizers are laying the groundwork for two new initiatives, the Electoral Justice Project and the Black Futures Lab that they say will address the way in which some Democratic candidates alienate the Black community. Identifying exciting candidates and deploying national resources to campaigns where they're needed is just one part of the Black Lives Matter electoral game plan. In November, the Movement for Black Lives Electoral Justice Project, an effort to educate and mobilize Black voters, will kick off with town hall gatherings in cities throughout the South and Midwest. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The destructive power of Hurricane Maria, which smashed tens of thousands of homes, knocked out electric power and phone service for most of Puerto Rico's 3.5 million residents, was the worst storm to hit the island in nearly a century. When the federal government's response was late to initiate rescue operations and provide emergency food, water, and fuel, criticism bubbled to the surface. But very few observers, however, would have predicted that in the midst of such a serious humanitarian crisis, President Trump would have launched a Twitter war against the people of Puerto Rico, essentially labeling residents as lazy. Among the public officials Trump attacked were San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz, accusing her of playing politics and being a poor leader. When the president arrived for a visit to Puerto Rico 2 weeks after the storm on October 3rd, he congratulated himself and his administration for its response to the disaster. In a bizarre moment, Trump then said the island should be very proud of its low official death count of 16, comparing the situation to Hurricane Katrina in 2005, based on the number of people who had died, implying that Puerto Rico's current crisis wasn't a real catastrophe. But the disastrous situation in Puerto Rico predates the ravages of Hurricane Maria. 60% of the island's children live in poverty, and its people have been dealing with a decades-long economic crisis that amassed a $72 billion debt, triggering the largest bankruptcy process in U.S. history. Your reporter spoke with Eric LeCompte, executive director of the Jubilee USA Network, who discusses island religious leaders and his group's advocacy of debt relief for both Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands after the devastation wrought by Hurricanes Irma and Maria.
In particular, we definitely want the bankruptcy process in Puerto Rico to continue to move forward. And that process is going to take into account the devastation of the hurricane and ensure a higher haircut in terms of the debt. In terms of the aid that comes from the United States, that comes from the federal government, we want it to be robust in the form of grants that goes in terms of relief aid to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. We don't want Puerto Rico or the U.S. Virgin Islands to have to get more debt in order to finance its reconstruction and recovery. It's also absolutely imperative that the aid comes in is sufficient to rebuild Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands in ways that are going to be able to withstand what seem to be more powerful and more frequent storms in this moment of our history. And the final piece that we and our partners in Puerto Rico are advocating, and it actually impacts many of the Caribbean islands that have been devastated by the storms, from Puerto Rico to the U.S. Virgin Islands to the countries of Antigua and Barbuda and Dominica, is that we really believe it's incumbent on Congress to pass greater laws around budget transparency, responsible lending and borrowing, because these types of laws prevent financial crisis. These types of laws actually secure protections in the markets, not only for the U.S. citizens living in Puerto Rico and U.S. Virgin Islands, but also in U.S. states and foreign countries, because much of the world's debt is actually contracted through New York law.
Eric, what is the prospect that we'll have a Republican-controlled Congress and Donald Trump as president be predisposed to sign into law some of these debt relief measures, given the hostility we've seen, particularly from the White House?
Well, in terms of Puerto Rico, the bankruptcy process that's in effect was passed last year with strong support from Republican leadership and Democratic leadership, and then signed into law by President Obama. And not only did that legislation delay debt payments for Puerto Rico in particular, that legislation is also what created this super bankruptcy process, the only bankruptcy process in U.S. history that has the ability to restructure all of Puerto Rico's debt. So in terms of Puerto Rico, they have access to this debt relief process right now, which is very positive. Unfortunately, we are dealing with a different situation with the U.S. Virgin Islands, where it's much more difficult for them to access this legislation. And in whatever relief package comes together for the U.S. Virgin Islands, in some way, Congress needs to deal with the debt. At this point, we don't know what that could possibly look like, but we're trying to engage Congress to include that in the package for the U.S. Virgin Islands because they absolutely don't have the resources to pay debt at this point.
Eric, what would you recommend people who are very much alarmed and their hearts going out to the people of Puerto Rico struggling with this disaster? What's an effective way they can help in the short term and the long term?
Well, in the short term, I think it's absolutely critical that we do let Congress know that being able to resolve the situation in Puerto Rico also means that we have to resolve the financial crisis. And listeners can go to our website, www.jubileeusa.org. Again, that's jubileeusa.org. And we have a petition that's up, which actually is going to the International Monetary Fund in order to secure debt relief and protections for Caribbean countries devastated by Irma and Maria, like Antigua and Barbuda, and the island of Dominica, a developing country totally devastated by Hurricane Maria. And that petition also goes to the White House, to Congress, and to those involved in the bankruptcy process and the governance on the island of Puerto Rico, calling for debt relief as well as to ensure that the island gets the proper amount of aid and grants.
That was Eric LeCompte, Executive Director of the Jubilee USA Network. Find more information and commentary on Puerto Rico's debt crisis and calls for debt relief by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On September 20th, Hurricane Maria flattened Puerto Rico and its electrical grid, plunging the entire island of 3.5 million people into darkness amid a late-season heat wave. 2 weeks later, just a tiny fraction of the power had been restored, and officials are predicting it will take 6 months to get the electrical grid back online. But the system that existed before the storm was almost entirely powered by dirty fossil fuels, like coal and oil. Despite the fact that the sun shines on the island almost every day, cheap, clean solar power was not being harnessed. The cruel irony is that the burning of fossil fuels intensifies climate change, which generates stronger storms with more rainfall, just like Maria. By some estimates, the island of Puerto Rico has the potential to become a learning lab for a conversion to renewable energy. Rather than importing coal and oil, which provides precious few jobs, local people could be hired to build out a sustainable energy grid using solar, wind, and other renewables. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program, who says the first order of business is to get the electrical grid up and running again. He then discusses some of the opportunities and obstacles that could stand in the way of such a wholesale conversion to renewable energy.
Puerto Rico has what's known as a municipally owned or a publicly owned power system. So as a result, the political entities in Puerto Rico have enormous leverage over the future direction of their electrical system because government institutions have total control over the operations of the utility. The problem in Puerto Rico is staggering debt. You've had a lot of younger, able-bodied people flee the island. The island finances in general are in not very good shape, and the utility itself was forced to declare bankruptcy. So to make new investments, and especially to contemplate significant new investments in different types of infrastructure, different types of renewable energy, is going to take money that right now Puerto Rico and its utility do not have. I think that one of the things that the United States ought to do to show a commitment to growth in Puerto Rico is to focus on investments that are going to help grow the Puerto Rico economy. And one way you can do that is by focusing on renewable energy. There's going to have to be outside capital, whether that's in the form of the U.S. federal government or private sector actors coming in.
What indications do you see that it's really feasible to convert Puerto Rico's energy grid to renewables?
What we're seeing in U.S. electricity markets is a new era of renewable energy dominance. We are seeing massive growth in the deployment of renewable energy, particularly what's known as utility-scale renewables in wind and solar. These are large-scale renewable installations. The economics of these types of deployments of renewable energy, they are outcompeting incumbent fossil fuel and nuclear power plants. This is just a remarkable technological period that we're in right now where renewables are ascending, and they are ascending rapidly. And so the question is, as we are contemplating changes to our electric grid, and particularly in the wake of a devastating natural disaster like what has afflicted Puerto Rico, there's an opportunity here to lay that groundwork. But the government always needs to play a role, and especially in the case here of Puerto Rico, given the special circumstances we have, the government has to play a leadership role in laying that infrastructure groundwork. And the question is the Trump administration just going to focus on a replacement and overlay of fossil fuel infrastructure, or is there an opportunity here for innovation and sustainability? And I think that it is important to have that conversation and to immediately start a feasibility study to assess what kind of renewable energy deployment we can get on to Puerto Rico in the medium term that are going to replace ineffective or damaged fossil fuel infrastructure. And, you know, rooftop solar has been an option, but the economical choice that is better than rooftop solar is utility scale solar, and that's where you've got, you know, large arrays in some sort of concentrated area. It can be on the top of a very large housing development or commercial development. The larger the system, the economies of scale drive those prices down. And so there is a huge opportunity here to start to consider what's known as distributed energy systems, that instead of having a handful of very large central power plants that historically have been powered either by fossil fuel, coal or natural gas, or by nuclear energy, instead you disperse dozens or hundreds of smaller scale units closer to neighborhoods and communities that are renewable, that are solar, that are wind. Studies have shown time and time again that these decentralized systems actually have greater resilience in the face of most types of reliability events or other types of natural disaster events. Because if you've got a centralized model, which is a handful of large power plants all connected by large transmission lines, you knock out some of that and huge geographic areas go down. Whereas if a storm affects one part of the island but not others, it's not going to knock out all of the decentralized grids. And so you're able to have greater resilience.
That was Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program. Learn more about the viability of renewable energy systems on Puerto Rico by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When Donald Trump campaigned on behalf of appointed Alabama Senator Luther Strange in the state's Republican Senate primary, he knew that his guy would likely lose. His former chief strategist, Stephen Bannon, along with his far-right website Breitbart and former GOP vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin, all supported Strange's opponent, Christian extremist Roy Moore, who won the election with nearly 55% of the vote. Moore is now the Republican nominee and frontrunner to win the Senate seat, vacated by Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions, in a December special election, where he'll face Democratic candidate Doug Jones. Roy Moore was twice elected Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, and twice removed from office for his refusal to remove a Ten Commandments monument from the state judicial building, and for defying a Supreme Court ruling invalidating Alabama's ban on same-sex marriage. Moore is well known for his belief that biblical law supersedes U.S. law and views that homosexuality should be a capital crime, Muslims should not be allowed to hold elected office, and promotion of the conspiracy theory that President Barack Obama was a Muslim not born in the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Frederick Clarkson, senior fellow with Political Research Associates, who discusses the significance of theocrat Roy Moore's GOP Senate primary victory in Alabama, the strength of the Christian right in today's Republican Party, and the threat posed to secular democratic values.
I mean, Roy Moore certainly sees the Constitution and the First Amendment as a vehicle for Christianity. He doesn't view it appropriate for Muslims to hold office. He specifically denounced the seating of Keith Ellison, the first Muslim member of Congress. And most interestingly, he calls Islam a false religion. But yeah, he believes that homosexuality and abortion should be criminalized. And he also doesn't think that the U.S. Supreme Court has the authority to do the things that they've done with regard to abortion rights and marriage equality.
Fred, I would ask you what the significance of his victory in the Alabama Republican primary for this open Senate seat means. What is the importance for our listeners to know about this win that he had the other day?
Well, there are a number of things. I mean, one is that he's demonstrated that the viability and the strength of the Christian right, both in terms of their ideological coherence and their organizational strength. And in Roy Moore's case, the peculiar alliance that is clearly forming between what we've always understood to be the Christian right and what we now know as the alt-right. It's a disturbing coalition that clearly was catalyzed by Donald Trump, but it shows that the political strength is there and that it's populist in the sense that Luther Strange, who was the incumbent Republican, was an established conservative, pro-business, supported by the Chamber of Commerce kind of politician. Exactly the kind of politician that Donald Trump had pledged to throw out. The people who elected Donald Trump still want to do that. And even though Roy Moore may seem wacky to some, he's an anti-establishment guy, and that's good enough for them.
Fred, what does the Republican establishment, quote-unquote, think about Roy Moore? You hear a lot of commentary after this primary victory by Roy Moore that people like Majority Leader in the Senate Mitch McConnell were unhappy because they thought it would make it more difficult for mainstream candidates to win the general election in other states if Roy Moore, like candidates, challenged incumbents in other places around the country.
Well, I think he's absolutely right about that. I think the good news for the Republican Party is that there really aren't any other Roy Moore-like candidates. There may be some Tea Party kinds of figures who are in the House who could make a plausible run at sitting senators like, say, Jeff Flake in Arizona. But, you know, Roy Moore is a one-of-a-kind character, and he's won statewide office twice. And it's very hard to find anybody remotely like Roy Moore who has done that. He's been one of the best-known and controversial politicians in the state for a couple of decades now. And it may be that characters like that arise, but we haven't seen them yet.
Fred, I would ask you, as you look at Roy Moore and the extremist wing of Christian political activists that he represents, what kind of threat do you believe it presents to our democratic values here in the United States today in 2017?
Well, you know, if you were going to hold a popular referendum on these things, they would lose. But it's often the case that it's the best organized faction, the best organized minority that prevails in politics. And if you look at Donald Trump and a lot of these characters, like Roy Moore, they came to Washington not to preserve it and to build it, but to destroy it. The way that we think about democracy and public life and the role of government, you know, the broadest swath of us, really. I mean, people like Donald Trump and Roy Moore and Steve Bannon are more like each other than any of them are like mainstream Republicans and anybody to their left. This is a revolutionary faction who is trying to figure out how to destabilize what we think of as democracy, and particularly the role of the federal government in preserving and advancing democratic values. That's their, that's pretty much their stated mission. And Roy Moore, if he becomes a U.S. senator, will be in an unusual position to do it. So he can go in and filibuster and put holds on judicial and ambassadorial nominations as much as he wants to, and he can be a real wrecking ball.
That was Frederick Clarkson, senior fellow with Political Research Associates, co-founder of the blog Talk to Action, and author of the book Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Find more commentary on Roy Moore's extremist religious views by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in East Orland, Maine, KDNK in Carbondale, Colorado, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.